scathing report to Truman by an emissary of Truman's from the University of Pennsylvania, Earl Harrison, that compared the camps that the United States was running after the war to the Nazi concentration camps. He said, Harrison wrote, that the only difference is that we're not exterminating the Jews, which, you know, think of that in hindsight. Patton...
Eric Lischbach, yes. We have to end the show, but we want to ask if you can stay, and we'll put part two online at democracynow.org. The Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times, his new book, published this week, The Nazis Next Door, How America Became a Safe Haven for Hitler's Men. You can read the prologue at democracynow.org. I'll be in Oslo, Norway, at Norway Social Forum, speaking Saturday, November 1st. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felsar-Amate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkafani, Masood Rabi, Karen Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2014 Asada Shakur Solidarity Community Event on Sunday, November 2nd from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing at 707 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. This event will have performances and talks from Portland's finest MCs, spoken word artists, and community organizers to reflect on Asada Shakur, former BLA political prisoner now exiled in Cuba. This event is in conjunction with the Jericho Movement's International Day of Solidarity with Asada and all political prisoners. Again, that's the 2014 Asada Shakur Solidarity Community Event, Sunday, November 2nd, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball. On the Day of the Dead, November 1st at 8 p.m., the lineup for this annual event includes Vagabond Opera, Shervona, Gothic Burlesque Belly Dance, Wandering Performers, Haunting Music, Ritual, Art, and the Sincere Honoring of Those Past. That's the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball. November 1st, 8 p.m. at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is 5:02 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, helping to make democracy work with printed and online voters' guides for the November election. You can check your library or voteoregon.org for more information and a guide personalized to your address. That's voteoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a woman in Milwaukee is hospitalized for precautionary testing for the Ebola virus.
The president of Burkina Faso resigns.
And the Federal Communications Commission comes out with a new plan on net neutrality.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 31st, 2014. I'm Sam Parrish.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Today, the Oregon Health Authority announced that a woman was admitted to Providence Milwaukee Hospital to test for the Ebola virus. This woman has not been diagnosed with Ebola. They reported she is isolated and represents no danger to the general public. The patient monitored the condition after recently traveling to West African countries where Ebola outbreaks have occurred. Her fever reached 102 degrees when she was transported to the hospital. Often, symptoms only appear 3 to 6 days after the virus was contracted. The Center for Disease Control advises states to quarantine patients if they exhibit a 100.4 degree temperature, along with other symptoms such as vomiting and diarrhea. If the state decides to test the patient, doctors will take a blood sample and send it to the CDC for testing. Once the blood sample arrives there, it'll take between 4 to 6 hours to be tested for results. Doctors continue to monitor the patient in Milwaukee and will wait to see if a test becomes necessary.
Last night, the Oregon League of Minority Voters held a pre-election event to press candidates and incumbents on issues impacting minority communities in Oregon. Dante James is one of those who spoke.
My name is Dante James, and I'm really supposed to follow that. I'm the director of the city's Office of Equity and Human Rights, and it's my pleasure to offer a few words here and really see the beauty of this room. I am encouraged by the work of the organization and just by its name. I think, as Sho said, it's the only one in the country, and there's a need for that. As we talk about minority voters, as we talk about who lives in this city, as you heard some of the earlier statistics about Portland Public Schools, and in city of Portland, 1 in 5 is foreign born. That's the future, and the future's here. And those are the voters of the future. And as I look around, apparently the minority voters are sitting out in the room. We're not up here at the dais. And what's the saying is, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So how do we get on the table? How do we get at the table? And we have to encourage and engage our communities to do that. We need to be asked, who is the next Lou Fredericks? We need to know the answer. Where is that pipeline? Who is the next Loretta Smith? Where is that pipeline? That's what we need to know the answer to as we encourage our communities to be a part of this process so we're not on the menu. We're talking about equity, at least in my office, and certainly with the mayor's support. Equity is about outcomes, not intentions. And I'll say that again. Equity is about outcomes, not intentions. And so that's where we need to focus. The road to where is paved with good intentions. And so it's the outcomes that we have to be concerned with. When we look at, as the Reverend said, the outcomes of who's incarcerated, who's not working, who's not graduating, who doesn't have health care, who is homeless. Pick an indicator, and I can tell you what they look like, what the faces look like. And so the importance of this group and you, as we talk about how do we engage and not be on the menu. How do we focus on outcomes? The city is looking at outcomes and equity as we focus on our budget. The mayor just recently put out instructions on the budget. And if you want new money as a Portland bureau, one of the only ways you can get new money is because you're focusing on equity and you have an equity outcome. When people are being hired at the city of Portland, if you're sitting on an interview panel, you will receive implicit bias training. So you understand your own implicit bias, what it is, and that you do in fact have it. We all have it, but what do we do with it? It's not our first thought, because we're going to have our first thought. It's what's your second thought, and what do you do with that? So those are the kind of things that improve and change outcomes. And that's what we're trying to do in the city of Portland with the support of and encouragement of and engagement of all of the residents of the city of Portland and beyond. So I look forward to the conversations and the discussions as they continue, and I would encourage us all to focus on the outcomes and looking for change. So thank you very, very much.
That was Dante James speaking at the Oregon League of Minority Voters event last night. Before the panel began, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg caught up with Mayor Charlie Hales and asked him to address the recent decision to appeal a settlement between the City of Portland and the U.S. Justice Department. Hales and other city officials argued that they should not have to appear before a judge each year to report their progress on addressing issues of the excessive use of force by the Portland police.
Hi, Mayor Hales. I'm with KBOO.
How are you?
Good.
I see you.
I was just wondering why you've decided to go ahead with the appeal of the judge's order on the settlement. It's something that's been criticized in the community.
Well, because I want it, let me say it this way, I want to take personal responsibility for our compliance with the Department of Justice settlement. I don't want any fuzziness or confusion about who's on the hook here. I am. And my police bureau. And we don't need to make anyone unclear about that by spreading the responsibility between me and a federal judge or anyone else. So that's the reason for this. It's not because we're trying to run away from the DOJ settlement. It's because we're trying to run toward it.
And you don't want to do that in front of a judge?
Happy to report to the judge, but I'm the commissioner in charge of the police bureau. I'm responsible for whether our officers are using force correctly or not, and I want the voters of the city of Portland to have somebody who's accountable to them in charge of these reforms.
Despite his claim that he is willing to go before a judge, Mayor Hales has filed an official appeal to try to avoid appearing before a judge as the settlement agreement requires.
Money continues to represent a major source of tension in this Tuesday's midterm elections. The campaign for Measure 92, Oregon's mandatory GMO labeling initiative, has surpassed $7.6 million with a new $100,000 contribution from the environmental advocacy organization Friends of the Earth. The No on 92 coalition, on the other hand, has gone over $19 million, with most of those contributions coming from large corporations such as Monsanto, PepsiCo, Dow, Aerosciences, and DuPont Pioneer. Each new dollar contributed to either side sets a new all-time record for spending on an Oregon ballot measure. As for Measure 91, the group Drug Policy Action recently contributed another $250,000 to the marijuana legalization campaign. Its overall donations reached almost 45% of the Measure 91's funding. Measure 91 campaign also reported that Representative Earl Blumenhauer of Oregon, a strong supporter of legalizing marijuana, made an in-kind contribution to the campaign in the form of a $40,020 in broadcast advertising. Measure 90, the campaign that would trigger a top two primary voting system in Oregon, received a $500,000 contribution from Texas billionaire John Arnold. Let me restate his name. It's John Arnold, a former natural gas trader. It has now raised $5.1 million in donations, while opponents have raised $1.4 million. The measure would eliminate partisan primaries in favor of a system that would advance the top two finishers to the general election, regardless of party or financial backing.
Today, Secretary of State Kate Brown visited the Riverwood Assisted Living Center in Tualatin to help senior citizens to vote. While the incident was intended as a photo op, Secretary Brown shared some important voting information. She reminded voters in Clatsop County, Hillsboro, and McMinnville that they must turn in supplemental ballots to vote in four races. They include the Clatsop County Community College Bond Measure, Cannon Beach City Council, Hillsboro City Council, and McMinnville City Council. Voters must turn in and sign both their original and supplemental ballots in separate envelopes. If you have any questions, contact your local elections office. You can call Clatsop County at 503-325-8511, Washington County at 503-846-5800, and Yamhill County at 503-434-7518.
Right now, if you purchase a gun from a licensed dealer in Washington State, under federal law, you must undergo a background check. But private sales, say if you buy a gun from your friend or a neighbor, do not require any kind of verification. On the ballot in Washington this November are two initiatives addressing these differences. Initiative 594 would require background checks for all private sales of guns. Initiative 591, on the other hand, would make background checks illegal unless mandated by the federal government. Reporter Ryan Katz takes us inside a place where many guns are privately bought, sold, and traded, a gun show.
When you arrive at the West Nodell Gun and Knife Show, the first thing you do is go through security. The man at the door is usually West Nodell himself, the show's promoter.
Show me the serial number on the gun.
Nodell and his security team zip tie the trigger of every gun that comes in.
That's our number one thing here is safety. Make sure that they're not loaded and then tie them to where they can't operate. So somebody couldn't pick one up off of a table and pull a trigger and it'll go off.
Inside, people walk through the aisles browsing the tables. Most are filled with guns, ammunition, even jewelry. Guns and ammo aren't allowed on the same table, by the way. A garlic festival is going on next door, and a couple of customers carry their garlic in one hand and their firearm in the other.
That's the neatest gun I've seen today.
One thing you notice right away at this gun show, there's a lot of bartering that goes on. Individuals show off their firearms looking to sell or trade them.
I just kind of wanted to show you. I really like it.
I appreciate you.
Next to the show's entrance is a table filled with antique firearms and parts. Sitting behind it in a plastic chair is George Bruholms, a retired carpenter from Seattle. He's been buying and selling antique firearms since he was 8.
The way I do it is I live in Seattle. So I come here, go to the gun show, and then I go down to Portland to see my brother. So everybody's happy, the wife's happy, I'm gone for a few days.
For George, selling guns is a hobby. He talks about guns like a kid brags about his Legos or toy cars. But this means he isn't a licensed dealer. He's a private seller. And Initiative 594 will affect private sellers like George the most.
If I can sell a few things to pay for the gas it cost me to get here, I'm happy. I'm really happy. If someone brings a gun in that shows me that I haven't seen before, that's cool.
If Initiative 594 passes, George will have to go through a licensed dealer to process the background check. But he says he applies his own background checks. Intuition.
You know, if a guy's an obvious gangbanger, I won't sell to him. And let's face it, if he's got his face all covered with tattoos and he's got tears under one eye, he's an idiot. He shouldn't have a firearm.
This may seem subjective for some, but George doesn't really see another option.
What are you going to do? If you're doing the background check, the guy just gets somebody else to buy it for him, do a straw buy. That's not going to stop. And he's not going to come here to buy the gun in the first place.
This is a classic argument made by a lot of firearm sellers. Most criminals do not buy guns at gun shows.
Only a small percentage of gun sales without background checks occur at gun shows.
That's Dr. Garen Wintemute, an emergency physician and director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at the University of California at Davis. He points to a 2002 study by the U.S. Department of Justice. It looked at 200,000 state prisoners who used a gun during a crime. Less than 1% bought it at a gun show.
Gun shows are not where the problem is the greatest. It's the most visible. Washington is not considering a gun show only measure. If they were, I'd be opposed to it. They're considering something much more comprehensive.
The same survey concluded that nearly 80% of prisoners got their guns on the street or from a friend. So that means that Dr. Wintemute agrees with private sellers like George Bruholms that gun shows aren't the biggest problem. But although they might agree on that, they come to very different conclusions on what should be done about it. Wes Nodell thinks that this means background checks don't work at all, like in his home state of Oregon.
As far as enacting a background check, it has done nothing to lower crime, period, other than create a minor inconvenience for law-abiding citizens.
Dr. Wintemute concedes that evidence on the effectiveness of background checks has been mixed.
That's been hard to establish comprehensively. A group of us is actually working on that right now.
Maybe the best example on the impact of background checks comes from Missouri, which had background checks and then did away with them.
In Missouri, after they got rid of comprehensive background checks, specifically firearm homicides went up by about 20%, there wasn't any increase in homicide by other means.
In other words, Dr. Wintemute says, although gun shows aren't the biggest problem, we do have some evidence that background checks work.
I have gone to something like 75 gun shows all around the country. In states that have background check laws, you just don't see people making sales off the books. I saw one in dozens of gun shows.
Anything you want to look at, you can just get in there. I know you.
And as for George Bruholms, if Initiative 594 passes, he'll still come to gun shows, but thinks that others probably won't.
We just do the paperwork, probably. A lot of guys will quit. The guys that'll hurt would be like the guy running the show here, because a lot of people will stop.
Gun show promoter Wes Nodell thinks that his business will go down by about 20% if Initiative 594 passes. He supports the other initiative, 591. If that passes, the state cannot conduct background checks unless the federal government says so. And if Washington votes for both initiatives, it's not clear what will happen.
That was KBOO's Ryan Katz in Centralia, Washington.
The Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, can host up to 1,575 detainees at a time. Most detainees inside the prison-like facility are immigrants going through deportation proceedings in immigration court. Critics say the corporation running the detention center, the GEO Group, exploits the detainees inside the center. This week, the Department of Homeland Security put their contract with GEO up for renewal. Any corporation can bid on the contract. KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Maru Morev Villalpando from Latino Advocacy on the contract's bidding process.
I'm wondering first if you could describe the GEO Group, the company that runs the Northwest Detention Center. What are they like as a company, and how do they treat the detainees inside?
Well, they are a big international company that makes billions of dollars in profits every quarter by, you know, incarcerating people throughout the world. They have 98 facilities across the world. Here in Tacoma, they're running the Northwest Detention Center, which is one of the biggest detention centers in the nation. They are a horrible company. What they do is that they make money out of having people in prison. They make money not only charging the government, but they also make money by ensuring that the detainees are hungry. Therefore, they will feel compelled to work, and then they will end up buying from the commissary. They make money by saving money, by not hiring people to run the kitchen, to do the laundry services, to do the janitorial services. And so it's a company that has been allowed by our government of the United States to oppress people and to exploit them. And like I said at the beginning, to make billions of dollars in profits every quarter.
So the federal government hires a private corporation like the GEO Group to run these detention centers. The contract for the Northwest Detention Center is ending in November. What are the steps moving forward?
The contract is, and this is very important, the contract is designed so Homeland Security and ICE have this operation being run by a company that is wealthy enough to buy the property, to be owner of the property and run it by themselves. So you have to have a lot of money not only to run the detention center, but to own the land and own the property. So when they open the bidding to other companies, basically they're saying, we want a huge international company like GEO to host all these people inside 24/7, 365 days a year, but you must be the owner of everything in there. So it's very unlikely that other companies will be able to compete with GEO by building a new detention center that hosts 575 people, that offers all the quote-unquote services that they are offering, and that is located within 30 miles distance from the airport in Seattle, Tacoma area.
Are there any competitors with the GEO Group that could potentially take over this contract, or are they pretty much assured a renewal of their contract?
The only other group that we know that could compete against GEO is Correction Corporations of America. They're the other private company that is running detention centers in this country. CCA, Correction Corporations of America, is unlikely to bid against a GEO, because they already have kind of their turf set. For us, the idea will be that nobody gets this contract and this detention center gets shut down.
What is the likelihood of that happening? Has there been any signs of progress in that way?
Not really. keep pushing, and we think that our work in organizing and in doing direct actions and supporting the work of the Colectivo de Detenidos inside the detention center has given a lot of movement. And just the fact that we're able to talk about these issues in public and that the public now is aware that these kind of places exist is moving in the right direction. But we haven't reached that level where we know we can shut down one of these locations. What has happened, though, in this detention center in the past month is that from 500 to 75 people capacity has gone down to between 800 and 900 people. We're still unsure why is that. For us, we know that GEO is losing money when they're not at capacity. We really don't think that, that GEO will not have this contract. And that doesn't mean, though, that we're not going to stop, that we're going to stop fighting. We will continue exposing the terrible conditions that they have people facing every day and the exploitation their people are going through while in the detention center.
I have been speaking with Maru Mora Villalpando from the Latino Advocacy Group. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
Today, the Washington State Attorney General filed three charges against a resident who tried to manually change the course of a river located near his home. William Kao is accused of using heavy machinery to fill and alter the course of the Taihuya River without any permits. He's been charged with violation of the Water Pollution Control Act, violation of the Shoreline Management Act, and conducting unpermitted hydraulic activities in connection with the alteration of the channel of the river. Kao allegedly used an excavator and a bulldozer to fill the river channel near his home and to redirect the river. Under state law, a property owner may work with the county and other agencies to develop a responsible, professional, and effective hydraulic or shoreline project that protects both private property and our natural resources. Unpermitted and improperly designed work in a riverbed or on a shoreline can damage neighboring properties, pollute the river, and kill fish. In this case, federal biologists concluded that over 5,000 meters of riverbed were removed to fill the active channel or to otherwise alter the streambed conditions in the river.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is a chance of showers with high of 59. Sunday we'll see rain with a high of 57. Today in history, in 1517, theologian Martin Luther posted his 95 theses on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany, setting off the Protestant Reformation. On October 31, 1984, Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated, triggering riots and the deaths of nearly 10,000 Sikhs. And on this date 3 years ago, the global population surpassed 7 billion people. The quote of the day comes from Harry Houdini, who died from a ruptured appendix on October 31, 1926. He proclaimed, "No performer should attempt to bite off red-hot iron unless he has a good set of teeth."
It's 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you want a real Halloween fright, don't look for it among the trick-or-treaters coming to your door. Just check out the Republican spooks trying to peddle panic in this political year. Early in the summer, their big scary was a few thousand Central American children crossing into the USA. This sent such excitables as Governor Rick Oops Perry skittering from one Fox News show to another, warning darkly that the children were agents of death who should be packed on buses pronto and shipped back to the rapes, gang warfare, and intractable poverty they were fleeing. But oops, the kids turned out to be, well, kids. No threat at all. So the fraidy cats found a new fear to stoke. Terrorists. Yes, squealed panicky GOP Congress creditor Duncan Hunter in early October. No less than 10 of the murderous Islamic terrorists from Syria and Iraq had been caught sneaking into the U.S. across our Mexican border. Duncan was implying that Islamic devils were coming to behead your entire family. Wow, that is scary. Only, it wasn't true. No terrorists were crossing. But truth is no deterrent to the determined fearmongers. So, next came Tea Party Frightmaster Representative Joe Wilson, trying to score a trifecta of fear by warning that 1, foreign terrorists who are 2, infected with Ebola, or 3, likely to sneak across the Mexican border to spread Ebola across America. I'm very concerned, Fraidy Cat Joe recently said, about the, quote, creed of Hamas. The wide-eyed Tea Partier told his audience that Hamas terrorists, quote, value death more than you value your life. Then he hit the code red panic button, offering this conclusion from the depths of his ignorance. Part of their creed would be to bring persons who have Ebola into our country. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's truly scary is that these screwballs actually hold positions of public authority in America.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The Federal Communications Commission is reportedly redrafting its proposed open internet rules. The new plan would reportedly, quote, separate broadband into two distinct services, unquote. This is exactly the type of so-called tiered internet that sparked millions of comments to the FCC in its recent public comment period. The two tiers of the internet would include a retail side in which consumers would pay broadband providers for internet access. The other tier would be a back-end service in which internet providers would be paid by websites to distribute content. Free Press called the announcement, made on Halloween, a Frankenstein proposal that's no treat for internet users. According to Free Press, the FCC is supposed to protect our communications, period. The group added that FCC Chairman Ted Wheeler can't wave a wand, change the law, and pretend to